D3. Number 2A.
Now, having seen that really the pith of Mitzvah's revelation is that there is nothing real and eternal, but principle and its infinite idea, actually one could ask, well, what about man and the universe? And because man and the universe is that which apparently we are so much interested in. Well, we have seen that God, who creates man, that God is obsolete as a term, because just a name, and a name doesn't really mean anything. What does a name mean? If I am called Max, what does it mean to you? Nothing at all. There's nothing in a name. Until one understands the nature and essence of something, it doesn't mean a thing. So if God is only a name, and that name has changed quite often in the Bible and afterwards, and now instead of it has been elevated to a scientific interpretation as infinite principle, well, if God is taken away, then man is taken away. The biblical or the mythological concept of man is taken away. And you know very well that in the study of Christian Science, the Christian scientists have a great pain in reading the textbook right the moment that term man appears, because man is spoken of as a mortal, as a corporeal man, a sinful man, a fallen man, then as the man of mortals, and suddenly as the man of God and the children of God, and then suddenly as spiritual man and incorporeal man and sinless man and perfect man. One has a whole range of the term man, and actually Mrs. Zedin tries to make clear that when she uses the term man, she means that term man which is created by God and not by people. But if there is no God, if being is principle, the nature of principle, the way principle expresses itself, manifests itself, is idea. That's the phenomena of the noumenon, principle. Principle cannot create something unlike its principled nature. And the principled nature is idea. The principle expresses itself in ideas. And so Mrs. Eddy could see that. I could see that really that which is created by the divine principle, or being brought forth by the divine principle, or that which constitutes the divine principle are ideas. And so we could just as well discard the term man. And I would see that time coming when we do. And I can only say that from the moment I tried to do it, at least for myself, as much as I could, to discard the people universe, the man universe, to try to demonstrate man, which is a name. Mrs. Eddy says, man is the family name for all ideas. It's a name. Man, as itself, doesn't mean a thing. It's a name. A name given to what? To all ideas. So why, if we see what is the nature of that which we have called man, is ideas, why then fall back constantly from that consciousness of ideas and associate it somewhere and somehow with the name man? It's a burden. It's a burden to do that. And it's misleading. Because mankind has been trained through thousands of years to believe that this body is called man, The moment we try to think clearly and scientifically about ideas, and that principle creates all in ideas, that the moment we try to ask the question, and this is main, we associate it somehow still with the concept of a human man. And this is too difficult. It can't work. It doesn't work. It's not right. So why not be scientists and see that all there is about reality is a universe of ideas, and that there is no necessity always to ask, and what is man? Once one has passed that sense of man and has seen that man is a name for what? For all ideas. And let's go on to those ideas, and let's stay there, and not go back constantly to a false concept, which is somehow always lingering in consciousness. And the moment one does that, one gets rid of that personal universe, of that universe of people, of seeing people arise, of seeing men arise. How can we see men arise if God doesn't see men, if God only sees ideas? If God only knows ideas, how can we see men arise? Only by seeing that we demythologize that man and see what it really meant, mind idea. So, Mrs. Eddy, you see, had the great task in front of her to lead mankind out of the concept of a man and of being man, out of that concept of being man and having to deal with men, into the realm of ideas, where there is nothing going on but principle and its infinite ideas. And it's enormously interesting to watch how she does perform that job. If one takes the textbook and reads it not as in a concordance-like way, but in a chronological way, from the first page to the last page, and watches how she develops that theme of God and man, God and man. Then one sees that she will speak naturally first of God and man, and first give to the reader a higher sense of man, a higher sense of God, and showing that man is not the man of mortals, that man is the creation of God, and little by little show that instead of God you can put the synonymous terms, and so on. And only when she comes to the end, towards the end of the textbook, and we always find the climaxes of her revelation in the last two or three chapters, then she begins to speak always about God and man as principle and idea. Then she takes those terms, God and man, and makes a comma and says principle and idea. She equates God and man to principle and idea. For instance, let me just read one. She speaks then that the relations of God and man, comma, divine principle and idea. See, it is, she spoke to a religious age and had to try to lift it out of the religious age into a scientific age, and said, by heaven's sake, see, that there is nowhere a God. That such a thing as a God you have in your imagination does not exist. What exists is a completely impersonal, incorporeal, infinite principle. And that the expression of that principle is but ideas. Nothing but ideas. That's the nature. Just as then the expression of the principle of arithmetic are numbers, as the expression of the signs of music are tones, so the expression of the divine, the infinite principle is ideas, not men, ideas. Man is a name for all ideas. Therefore, instead of putting the term man, we could put a compound idea. But once we have arrived at the higher sense, why go back to the old sense? Why not go forward? Go forward in consciousness. So it says, the relationships of God and man, comma, divine principle and idea are indestructible in science. Or you will say, in divine science, God and the real man are inseparable as principle and idea. See, she always gives to the religious statement the scientific interpretation. Says, what is really God and man is really principle and idea. She says, in so many ways, she says that, and then finally, in the last pages, two pages or so, she speaks that the human sense of deity yields to the divine sense. See, the human sense of deity yields to the divine sense. All right. That's the religious sense. Even as the material sense of personality yields to the incorporeal sense of God. All right, that's the religious sense. That the corporeal sense of God and man yields to the incorporeal sense of God and man. But it's still religious, it's God and man. But it yields, as he said, to the incorporeal sense of God and man as what? As the infinite principle and its infinite idea. And this is the acme of her textbook. So right from the beginning of chapter, where she introduces God of good and the man of God's creation, she worked it up and worked it up and worked it up step by step and step to the recognition that in a scientific age we are not dealing with mythological names like God and man, but that we are dealing with scientific terms, and these are principle and idea. Apparently Mrs. Eddy once has said that it would be the much greater achievement that the great achievement than healing sickness would be to heal oneself of a people universe. People are hell. People are just hell. People are hell let loose. I don't know what hell we can have more than to have to do with people. You seem to be very nice people. But, you know what I mean. Let's see that being is of the nature of principle and idea. And if one sees that, there is a great load falling from our shoulder. That's why in trying to explain what that term man is and lifting it out of that sense that it is someone, she calls man not no more a he who, but a that which. And that that question, what is man, in recapitulation, she gives us the answer, among others, that man is that which. No more he who, no more a she who. It's a that which has no separate mind from God. Can you see that? But that which we have called man, we can just drop. And see, in place of it is really only that truth which has no separate mind from God. Therefore, it's the mind of God, the mind of Christ. That is man. To have the mind which is God. To have that mind which is God. And mind, she says, expresses itself only through the idea of mind. And through nothing else. And cannot be learned from its opposite, matter. So let's drop every attempt to try to find out the nature of man by reasoning from man. That's the great mistakes we make. That we say, here I have somebody and he looks pretty much as a mortal, and I'm going to see that's the true idea of man, which is reasoning from the mortal to the idea of man, which is not scientific reasoning. In science of mind, we start from mind and learn the ideas of mind. And therefore, we are not considering there where we see a mortal to see the immortal. We are going out from the infinite one in Christian science, which has an infinite idea, and that idea is the idea of God. Now, you can come along and say, but Mrs. Eddy, and the Bible says that in the sixth day of creation, the Bible says that God created man. Yes? But the Bible is symbolism. It tries to show through symbolism the great facts of being. And taking the exegesis of Mrs. Eddy, we see that what she says there is that man is the image and likeness of God. Well, does an image and likeness of God look like man? Whatever, we have a holy sense of man. The image and likeness of God is God. God cannot see himself and know himself other than himself. But the very fact of this contemplation has been symbolized in the Bible through the term mind, through the symbol man. Because God's consciousness of himself, that's the sixth day of creation, showing the nature of being as truth, or truth consciousness of himself, truth self-consciousness of himself, that self-consciousness, that very fact that being is self-consciousness, had to be symbolized somehow. They didn't know a term consciousness. They were not trained in psychology and so on. They were living 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, and had jolly well to symbolize something with those very crude symbols they had at their disposition. And the only thing they could think of in the whole world which had consciousness was that chap called man. So they took that term, that symbol, man, to symbolize God's consciousness of himself. You see, let's make a very simple reasoning. We take the first day of creation, where God said, let there be light. And we all agree that that light was not the sunlight, nor the electric light, nor the candle light, but that it was a symbol. To symbolize what? To symbolize God's nature as mind. To symbolize God's nature as that which brings vision, enlightenment, that which is intelligence, that which brings new comprehension, new apprehension, intelligence, and so on. And to symbolize that, they use the symbol light. But once we have seen that symbol light and have seen that spiritually the story of the first day of creation wants to teach us that the nature of God is enlightenment, no one of us would think that every time there is enlightenment there must be sunlight or candlelight or electric light, or it isn't right. We would never dream of that, would you? What about the sixth day? Why do we not stick to the same method? In the sixth day, those great spiritual seers wanted to express that the nature of being is God's consciousness of himself. God being aware of itself, God knowing itself, God being comprehending itself. Therefore, in order to symbolize that consciousness, they took the only thing they could think of which had consciousness, namely man. So they said, man is that symbol. So that was symbolized through man. But once we have seen that, we shouldn't make the mistake of seeing that the sixth day of truth is God's consciousness of itself, and then say, this is man. This has to do with man. It has to do with God. It is God's own knowledge of itself. And that's that. And we leave the sinful man right behind us. And resurrect ourselves right above that mythological sense of man, of being man. And rise out of it. And don't try to find a connection link, neither between enlightenment nor not sunlight, nor between God's own consciousness of itself with any sort or shape or form of man. Let's just stay there, in being, where we are quite happy and satisfied that we don't need to have a personal universe, the universe of people, a universe of men, but that we have to do with that great statement that God is conscious of itself. And you know what the funny thing is, not the funny thing, but it's a funny thing insofar that we don't read really what Mrs. Eddy says in that exegesis of the sixth day of creation. Mrs. Eddy would say that this likeness, this image of God, that this likeness is seen everywhere. She doesn't say that this likeness is seen everywhere where a mortal appears. Says everywhere. Therefore, it isn't an answer to those 3 billion men or people. She says that this true likeness is seen everywhere. Now, to me, everywhere is everywhere. To me, everywhere is not there where 3 billion people appear. To me, everywhere is everywhere. She says, all reflect life, truth, and love in that paragraph. She explains that sense that God made man in his image and likeness. She lifts that whole sense that it has to do anything with man or with the true concept behind those 3 billion mortals, lifts it right out of that false sense and says, no, God's consciousness of itself is everywhere. And God's consciousness of itself reflects itself everywhere. And not just where a man appears. Everywhere. And everywhere is everywhere. One just gets the expanding sense, you know. Well, we don't have any more to ask. Well, I have to do with this and this chapter, and he's pretty tricky old boy. But I think as a Christian scientist, I should see him in the true light. I should see there as the true man. Why? Why there, if it's everywhere? We are going to finitize Mrs. Eddy's statements, right and left. We always finitize and finitize the infinite ever-presence of the one being and finitize it and says, in that corner it is, in that body it is, in that place it is. It's everywhere. All expresses life, truth, and love. And in that measure, as one begins to love that more and see that more and get rid of that mythological sense of man and takes on the scientific sense of that sixth day of creation, that scientific sense which says, okay, old boy, always go out from principle. Elohim was saying, let us, the plural, life, truth, and love, make man in our image and likeness. Therefore, let life, truth, and love be seen as everywhere reflected. As what? As life, truth, and love. Life, truth, and love is never reflected as an image of man, neither as a mortal nor as a spiritual image of man. Life, truth, and love never loses its sense of life, truth, and love. No one who looks into the mirror sees in the mirror something which is different. Obviously, sees in the mirror exactly the same. So God doesn't see himself as a man. He always sees himself as God. Now, God is obsolete. Life, truth, and love always is conscious of itself as life, truth, and love. This very great fact, this very great fact that came into being, that God or being is consciousness, is infinite consciousness, that was symbolized by man. But it is consciousness. I always think about something very simple in addition to that. Namely, that the Bible tells us not of 6 days of creation. The Bible has 7 days of creation. And the seventh day of creation has nothing to do with man. The term man doesn't appear. But we, in consciousness, do get hold of the seventh day. Which means that we are more than the 6 day. That we can grasp something higher, namely the seventh day. And the seventh day is the most interesting day. Mostly, as far as I could see, and I experienced it with myself in my own study, I was always somehow narrowed down in a way to interpret that seventh day as the day of peace and rest. God rested. Gave me a sense of perfection and of rest and of peace, of completion. But then one reads Mrs. Eddy's exegesis, and that exegesis runs over a page and a half. She puts very little stress on explaining peace and rest and perfection. Most of her exegesis is on a much bigger subject. The subject of today, the subject of our youth, the subject of the new consciousness that is coming. Namely, she speaks there all about the question, can human capacity understand the infinite? And says it can't, but she shows that the infinite understands the infinite. And at least the seventh day, and that's the day of creation, it's our day. It's our day when we shouldn't be interested so much what is man. Where we should be interested to see that with the consciousness of the infinite, we are living, moving, and having our being in the infinite. It's full of paradox. And you know, the greatest spiritual teachings can only be given humanly in paradoxes. Is that the right plural form, paradoxes? That the unfathomable mind is fathomed. That the unfathomable mind is expressed. That the height and depth and length and everything is expressed. She breaks there, right through, that which today is coming up on Western world, that all thinking will be from the infinite, and the infinite knows the infinite, and that we come to a new period where we go out from the infinite and stay with the infinite and never leave the infinite. And where we free ourselves from that sense that we cannot know the infinite. She only says human capacity is not adequate. But she has shown in through the 6 day that man is more than that. That really man is only a symbol for what? For life, truth, and love knowing itself. So the moment we get hold of the 6 day of creation, it opens up wide. The further step of the seventh day of creation, where we begin to see that our consciousness is the infinite. That the infinite can never split up in any part. Nothing can split up the infinite, or it is no more infinite. So if the infinite cannot be split up, then what we are aware of is infinitude. And you know that the young people somehow long to touch that. The new consciousness in art, in literature, in cybernetics, everywhere, tries to touch that very fact. That we should not work up to the infinite, but see that because the infinite is consciousness, and because we are integrated into that infinite consciousness, we are infinite consciousness, and therefore are aware of the infinite in every shape and form. For the theologian, this seems sacrilegious. For the scientific, it seems to be the only logical answer. So, can you see how in this way we begin to realize that the whole answer lies in understanding those seven synonymous terms, because each term stands for the infinite. It is interchangeable for the infinite. But each term depicts the infinite in another way, in an infinite variety of ideas. And so we have an infinite which is not just one unit, but an infinite which is infinite in its ideas. The infinite one is not one unit, one infinite mass, one infinite amorphous mass, formless, diffuse, one. The one infinite is an infinite of infinite diversified, classified, and individualized ideas. And the moment we begin to see how they are diversified, classified, we can have a science of ideas built on that.